I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, February 25th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off all your cell phones. Members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, and I am Senator Giesel. Senator Dunbar is excused today, and Senator Wilkowski is presenting a bill in another committee. But we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Jude, who are keeping the minutes and running the audio for us. We have three presentations today. Mining update from the Alaska Miners Association, Red Dog Mining update by Tech and Nana, and lastly, Critical Minerals and Accelerator Project by the Critical Minerals Collaborative. So I'm going to allow about 30 minutes for each presentation, and I'll keep an eye on the clock, so don't worry about that. So we'll start out first with the Alaska Miners Association doing our annual mining update. So I will welcome Deantha Skabinski. She's the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. Dave Larimore is the Chief Exploration Officer at Contango Ore. And you are the president this year of AMA, am I correct, Dave? Yes. And Mike Satry, we know, he lives here in Juneau, the Director of Government Affairs for Hecla Mining. So welcome to the three of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Deantha Skabinski. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. We are the statewide mining industry trade association that represents all aspects of the mining industry, from large metal mines and projects, our state's one coal mine, our placer mining industry, industrial mining, and then the contractors that service and support our industry.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having us here today. My name is Mike Satry. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for Hecla Mining Company. Hecla is a 135-year-old American mining company based in North Idaho. We have operating mines in Idaho, Alaska, the Yukon, and Quebec. Our biggest and best asset is the Greens Creek mine right here in Juneau. It is the largest silver producer in the United States, and Hecla as a whole produces 37% of the silver in America.
Well, good afternoon. Dave Larimore, Contango Ore. Madam Chair, just a quick correction. I got promoted to Vice President of Exploration for Contango Ore a couple weeks ago. So if you do something right, I guess you can move your way up there. Additionally, the statewide president for AMA and the state chair for that. I would like to briefly start off today with a quick safety share, if I may. Safety is obviously our number one priority, our number one pillar and value in the mining industry. A lot of times we take the day to start our day off, we just kind of do our safety shares or our tailgate meetings, and we ask ourselves, why do we want to go home safe and healthy every day, and what do we think our biggest risk is? So I'd like to share mine briefly. I work safe and healthy today because I want to go back home north to Fairbanks. I want to be able to see my wife. I want to see my puppy up there. And also I want to be able to have the opportunity this weekend to go out and enjoy our great outdoors in Alaska. My biggest hazard today that I've assessed is probably going to be a slip, trip, and fall on these icy conditions and these roads out there. So I'm mitigating that by taking a little extra time walking, not rushing to my meetings, making sure I have sure footsteps, and taking some alternate plans or alternate routes if it's too busy up there. But that's how I'm going to work safe and healthy today. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Deantha Skabinski, Alaska Miners Association. So we're here today to deliver our annual mining update, thank you, and also to share what we believe is the industry that's interesting is entering a structural paradigm shift driven by federal and state policy changes, national strategic demand for minerals, and evolving development models. It couldn't come at a more important time because we are at a critical juncture for economic growth in our state. So today we're going to walk through what has changed, why it matters to the state, and what alignment can look like going forward. So we'll talk about the state of the industry. We'll discuss last year of changing federal and state regulatory policy. We'll share in depth the FAST 41 process, what it is and what it isn't. We'll discuss whether what the state of Alaska can do now to fully capitalize on this situation and share a long-term vision for mining in Alaska. So to start, I'm sharing a map from our 2024 annual report, and there's a reason for that. This shows the current large-scale operating mines in Alaska and some of the projects at that time that were in exploration and or permitting. The seven operations on here are economic anchors of the region they're located in. They're the largest private sector employer, and they're the largest local government taxpayer, high-wage jobs, all while maintaining a strong environmental performance and being good neighbors. Something we can't portray on this map, but I'd like to take a second to point out, are the roughly 300 placer mines we have distributed around the state, producing gold on private, federal, and state lands, from the Haines area out to coastal southwest Alaska, in interior, up the Canadian border, and up to Nome in the Arctic Circle. They range in size from 1 to 25 employees, but collectively, if you put them in aggregate, they have a similar economic impact to one of the large-scale mines that we profile. Now I'm moving to our 2026 map, and as you can see, it's a bit busier. 2024 showed 7 large-scale mining operations and 8 projects that we would consider in permitting or advanced exploration status. This map shows an additional 12 active exploration projects and an additional operating mine. I do want to be clear, this isn't a declaration of, oh, the federal administration changed and all of these projects suddenly popped up. You all know that industry in Alaska doesn't work like that. But a few observations that we can draw in the last 5 or so years are a number of factors changed the global mining supply chain and really changed the landscape of mining in Alaska. The pandemic and the country realizing we couldn't just snap our fingers and get whatever we wanted showed really how vulnerable we are. And geopolitical events, very much improving commodity prices, a number of things that made it evident that we needed to portray these exploration projects as a long-term vision for Alaska's mining industry. So to put that in a more brief term, we are looking at one of the strongest development pipelines Alaska has had in decades.
But Ambler isn't on there.
So we, Madam Chair, I would definitely suggest that you pose that question to Dr. Lance Miller when he comes up here. But we have, from residents of the region, gotten feedback over the years that they would like us to portray this map as Upper Kobuk. And there are a number of different deposits in that area.
Gotcha.
But the geologist will give you a better answer than that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Oh, good. He approves.
Yes.
And thank you for the question.
Yeah, a question on this, because I noticed Pebble on here, still continues to be on here. There was a court filing on February 17th by Department of Justice saying that basically the Trump administration continues to oppose the proposed mine. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that and how it impacts the potential for that to not be on the map next year.
Senator Kawasaki, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. What happened this past week is that the Department of Justice filed its reply brief to litigation from the Pebble Project. The Pebble Project is suing the EPA for a preemptive veto, so the veto that was issued while they were in the pieces of their permitting process. The reply brief from the Department of Justice outlined what their defense was on behalf of the agency to the litigation. I would still consider this very much to be an exploration project that is going through what is sadly a phase of permitting a mine, which is litigation.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'll let you proceed.
Just making sure I'm done. Yes. So each year we contract with the McKinley Research Group to perform a study of our industry's economic and community benefits. They collect data from the mining companies themselves, but also Department of Labor, Department of Revenue, et cetera, to come up with the big picture of all of the economic benefits across our state. I won't read this screen to you, but just highlighting a few. 12,400 jobs attributed to the industry with an average wage of $122,000. Workers live in over 85 Alaska communities, many of those where there are not other employment opportunities, and they're in rural Alaska. Last year, mining paid $92 million in state revenue, $47 million to local governments, and $240 million to Alaska Native corporations, bringing ANCSA revenues to $3.6 billion since 1989. The full committee report, and thank you to your staff, the full McKinley report is in your committee packet and has a lot more data, but in the interest of time, I'll take it from there. But the key takeaway from this information is mining is scalable, private sector growth bodes very well for our state's economic future.
Pause for one moment. Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Yeah, thank you. I did have this question. So when AOGA came here, I said the same thing. Metal mining, the residency report came out in very early in February. It's been tracked since 1992 or so. In metal mining in particular, it shows that the residents – non-resident is close to 44.2%. It's the highest it's ever been. It's a trend that at least in 10 years has gone from 33.5% to 44% non-Alaskan hire. And I'm just curious why that trend seems to continue, what options are there for changes? And just in the last year, prior year on year, the total number of non-residents increased by 122. The total number of residents decreased by 116. And so it looks like a one-to-one swap. Can you explain it?
So through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, there's a number of factors.
Mr. Satre, would you identify yourself?
Yes, apologies. For the record, Mike Satre with Hecla Mining and through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. There's a number of factors at play here. I think first and foremost, you have to start with the demographics of the state of Alaska are against us. Depending on which region you're in, overall, we've either held flat or slightly declined in population, and we have an aging population. So we have less and less people entering our workforce. And they have a multitude of choices as they go forward. Maybe they'll go to college, maybe they'll go to a career and technical education center. But there, you know, that workforce is desired really around the world, whether it's an oil and gas, mining program, whatever it is. So we are competing for a dwindling local workforce here. Mines have invested significantly in our university system, in local workforce programs, to be able to hopefully increase our local workforce. In fact, today, representatives from both the Greens Creek Mine and the Kensington Mine here in Juneau are at the Juneau Innovation Summit talking about the issue of non-resident workers and what the two mines are doing specifically to build regional capacity so that we have more locals working at our mines. Just yesterday at the Juneau Mining Forum, there was a fantastic panel with kids from Juneau who had gone through the Mining and Petroleum Training Service Delta Mine Training Center training and now have jobs where they're, you know, making six figures a year just a few years out of high school, and they love the mining industry, and it was just fun. It was really enlightening and heartening to hear them talk about how much fun it is. So, you know, the reality is it is very hard to find enough people to fund our mines. That doesn't mean we're abandoning Alaska communities. We are investing in everything we can for a local workforce. But in the end, we have to produce, and we will bring in whoever we need to do to make that happen. Hopefully, then we as a state and as a community show them that Alaska is a great place to live, and they move here and they stay here and raise their families.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, I'll let you go ahead.
For the record, Deantha Skavinsky, Alaska Miners Association. I gave Mike the side eye on that because I thought it would be helpful for you to hear directly from an operation. But I do want to share that I collectively hear that exact same message from all of my operating mines and project members. They're all, in fact, they have revived our longtime Human Resources and Workforce Development Committee, where the HR managers at companies meet once a month to share information, talk about how they can support some of the training programs around the state. But it is a shared issue across all the mines and projects.
You know, I'll just add something on that topic. It'd be interesting to know how many of those out-of-state employees are residents who have moved their families out of state, but now are non-residents working here. That is, retained their job here, but the families moved outside. I actually have heard from a very large company that phenomenon is happening there, and he's having to build man camps now to house former Alaska residents. Just a thought.
Senator Giesel, Deantha Skavinsky, Alaska Miners Association. That is a story I hear quite often as well.
Yeah.
A lot of those times, we could probably take a whole committee hearing on this, but a lot of those times, it gets you down to a community discussion, housing, childcare, all of the things that you guys grapple with all the time.
Yes. I'll let you go forward. Oh, pardon me. Senator Klayman has a question.
Before you go to the next slide, you're listing $92 million in state of Alaska revenue, in contrast, ANCSA royalty payments, just recent $240 million, $3.6 billion since 1989. For the state of Alaska revenue, what is the state revenue? Is that taxes or something else? And also, subset, is the state got any royalty payments in the mix?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that number is comprised of taxes, fees, royalties, revenues to the railroad and ADA, et cetera. So that's any way that Alaska takes revenues in. I'm trying to remember the second part of your question.
I'll ask it slightly differently. It looks like the Native corporations actually have a lot of very good lands in terms of properties in terms of mining and revenue and royalties for those mines. Does Alaska not really have a lot of lands that are particularly good mining properties for purposes of getting royalties?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I'm not allowed to call them good or bad mining properties, but I will say we do only have one large mine on that is primarily on state land paying a royalty right now. The other operations are on federal land or private land, such as the Red Dog Mine, so that just the Pogo Mine is the only mine that's primarily on state land, so paying that royalty.
And one more follow-up. And is that, I think someone cynically said, the reason the state tends not to have as many good properties in that way compared to some of the native corporations is because we got third choice in terms of selecting lands. Is this a reflection of some of the places where we didn't get first choice in terms of getting different properties?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I don't really know the answer to that. I have not had those conversations at AMA before. I will say that the map that I showed you earlier with a lot of exploration projects, there are a lot of really prolific deposits on state land that could become an operating mine in the future and could greatly compound our contribution to royalties.
Okay. And eventual trust lands.
If I may, Dave Larimer, for the record, through the chair, Senator Klayman. I would also like to add that I would say, yes, there are a lot of our Alaska Native corporations did get a great choice. They were chosen because they were mineralized lands for that reason. Secondary, for the state lands, it's a large package, and the geology is not really well known. You know, we fight as geologists to bring up our geologic knowledge across the state so we can find out where mineralization is, so we can develop those projects through there. So I would counteroffer that Alaska state lands is just so large that we have to figure out what we have in front of us.
And again, Dianthus Kaminsky, Alaska Miners Association. I'm trying not to sound too editorial or advocacy here, but I will say if you look at the Pebble deposit, that is a deposit that was chosen specifically by the state of Alaska because of its immense potential. So that is something where they did kind of get their first pick, if you will.
Thank you.
Very good. I think we're ready for the next slide.
Okay. Another topic that would take an entire committee meeting, and again, you have indulged us and included in your committee packet a handout on environmental performance, so it has a lot more detail than what I'm going to tell you right now, but still very important to recognize and discuss the environmental performance of mines in Alaska. Just to summarize a few very important points, permitting process does not guarantee a yes. In many cases, there is a back and forth process that happens with the project proponent and state agencies before a formal application is filed that the public has a chance to weigh in on. And what I mean when I say that is that the mining company takes a proposal into the agencies and the agencies review it and say, we think you could have done this better and we want to see this change. And there is a back and forth perfecting of that application before it goes out before the public. So the misnomer out there that the state never says no, many times the state says no before a formal permit process starts. Also, once a mine is fully permitted, I'm using air quotes, they will have dozens of federal, state, and local permits in hand to be able to operate. At the end of once they get those permits, the regulation doesn't stop there. There's strict operational oversight throughout the life of the mine. There's financial assurance held by the state of Alaska to ensure that cleanup never falls on the back of public dollars. There is a reclamation plan that is required by law to be approved by the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner before operations can start. And I have listed here three really recent and great reclamation examples. The Grant Mine in Interior Alaska has a tailings facility fully reclaimed and signed off by the state of Alaska. Uso Valley's Poker Flats received phase three bonding sign-off, meaning it went through all of the recontouring, regrading, revegetation to essentially store the land back to what it was like before the coal was mined there, and that has signed off. And then the True North Mine in Interior Alaska was operated by Fort Knox, and it was the first metal mine to be fully reclaimed and accepted by the state. So it's nice to have some of those modern examples to share with you, if you will. So we operate under some of the most rigorous environmental standards in the world, and it's not the question isn't if we regulate, it's, do we do it with predictability and capacity? And in one of Dave's slides, he's going to kind of get into the state angle of that. So I've laid out the important benefits, the environmental record. As the United States looks at the concept of increased domestic mineral production, we have maintained that mined in America is going to be mined in Alaska. I'm going to turn it over to Mike for a moment. He's going to go through the federal regulatory shift, but I do want to leave you with a few things to keep in mind. Your committee, we have all been inundated with the term critical minerals in the last decade or so. There's disagreement amongst the definition and how it's applied to decision making. And at the end of the day, all of the minerals that we use to go into important applications, defense, grid modernization and stability, whatever it might be, they're all critical because they're all strategic assets to society. In many cases, critical minerals term was used to identify the less commonly produced minerals that we're heavily reliant on from foreign nations, in many cases adversarial. Those minerals are often not produced viably on their own, and they are produced when mining is taking place for copper or zinc or silver or gold. So there is becoming awareness of this, thankfully, and federal policy now prioritizes domestic production incentives to be pushed to all minerals and not just critical minerals. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike. Thank you so much.
All right. For the record, Mike Satry with Hecla Mining. As Ms. Skibinski, started out, we've seen an incredible shift in attitudes and awareness of the mining industry in the last 6 years, post-COVID. During that time period, we realized our supply chains overall were at risk, that our domestic mineral production was waning, and we were dependent on adversarial nations for many of the things that power our daily lives and our national defense imperative. So starting with the Biden administration, and specifically the Department of Energy and then the Department of Defense, realized that we need minerals for energy, we need minerals for our national defense, and there was a shift in that administration towards incentivizing domestic metal production, and we saw some great things that started there. But in the past year, we've really started to go full throttle on trying to realize America's potential and Alaska's potential in the mining industry. So, from day one, we saw the Alaska-specific executive order that looked at removing any unnecessary hurdles to energy and mineral production. Later on in 2025, in March, we had an executive order to immediately increase American mineral production and look at how we can bring projects forward in the permitting process. And that's incredibly important because even though we all now realize the importance of the mining industry to our nation, there was an S&P Global study that came out last year that says, on average, from discovery of a resource to mine production in the United States, it takes 29 years. And so, there's a lot of things that the geologists have to do on the front end to be able to find and define and develop that deposit and get to a point where it can be permitted and ultimately construct into operation. But what we really have to do is make sure we are not getting in our own way on the permitting process. So we've seen lots of actions from the administration to move that forward. We've seen the Ambler Road approval. We have deregulatory agendas that have been implemented in Department of Interior at USDA. To move these things forward. We've seen a change in approach on the critical mineral list, and we've had several new metals added to that. We now have silver, lead, copper, zinc, all on those lists. These are the minerals that we produce right now in Alaska. And gold's been recognized by the president as critical in his executive orders. And that's important because that designation by the agencies really allows the other laws, the other statutes that are out there, allows us to utilize that critical mineral designation for priority organization, financial incentives, and hopefully predictable permitting as we go forward. And then, last year in the reconciliation bill, there was over $8 billion in critical mineral initiatives that were funded. And I think you're going to hear about the potential of some of that later on in the presentations today. When we talk about critical mineral accelerators, money's coming from National Science Foundation. Department of Energy is sitting on over $400 billion of loan authority for critical mineral projects. And you can just go down the line of what Department of War is doing right now as well. But I talked about that 29-year time frame. That's much longer than a presidential administration. We have to have durable permitting reforms. The mining industry is going to be here for multiple administrations, multiple Congresses. And so that's why we're working hard in Congress right now to put some of these permitting reforms into statute. And we've seen the Speed Act, which would make NEPA more predictable, and the Permit Act, which would make the Clean Water Act process more predictable. Those have passed the House, and now they're sitting in the Senate. And we're hopefully going to work with the EPW committee to get those moved forward and get some version of that permitting reform passed by both houses and signed by the president so that we do have that permitting predictability going into the future. But one of the, in the meantime, as we work through all of this, one of the big tools that's been utilized to help mining projects go forward is the FAST-41 process. And I thought I'd take a little bit of time to talk about that today, because it's new to a lot of people and there's some confusion about what it means and what it doesn't mean. And this was first implemented in 2015. And by FAST, they didn't mean we're going to very quickly permit everything, but it was fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, because they realized there was permitting impediments to simply building bridges and maintaining our highways and doing all the things that DOT does. And so they created the Federal Permitting Improvement Steering Council so there would be a coordinated permitting function at the federal government to move these forward. In 2021, mining was added as a covered sector to the FAST-41 process. And so that opened up some great opportunities. So to be a covered project and to receive that full benefit of federal coordination, you have to be subject to NEPA. You have to have a fairly high investment threshold of $200 million. So you're going to be essentially building a mine if you're at that point. And you have to go through an application process with the permitting council. But you get it, once you're accepted into that, then you're on the dashboard. The agencies sit down and agree on a permitting timetable. And now the public can see what's going to happen. The agencies know what benchmarks they're going to have to hit. And if they can't hit them and there's disputes between agencies, the permitting council actually has a formal resolution process to make that happen and keep it moving forward. And, you know, it started out for a long time. We only had one covered mining project in the United States. Now we have three covered projects right here in Alaska. There's also the FAST-41 transparency list. So it provides some of the same benefits of coordination, but it's a little bit lower level. And this really came out of the executive order in March, which looked at identifying projects that could be permitted or permitted quickly. And by getting on the transparency list, you're able to get on a permitting dashboard, have some timelines and schedules set, the public's aware of what's going to happen, and there's clarity and transparency and some predictability, and the ability of the permitting council to assign resources to those projects, even during government shutdown. So we now have three projects in Alaska that are on that transparency list moving forward, and there's many, you know, throughout the United States right now. So it doesn't change any of the environmental requirements to permitting. It simply puts time schedules and predictability into permitting.
So, you had a question, yeah. Senator Rusher?
Thank you, through the chair, Madam Chair. So how much time do you think this could shave off a project? You talked about 29 years in the beginning, and now you're talking about a FAST-41 process, which definitely escalates some of this. So how much time do you think we could shave off of these three projects that you're talking about?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, and still Mike Satry for the record, we're going to talk about that just a little bit. We've got some examples of some FAST-41 covered projects. And I think Mr. Larimer is going to have a great example there. Having set time schedules and having dispute resolution procedures is incredibly important so that all the agencies are at the table moving that project forward in an efficient manner. And so years potentially off of the big projects. I'm going to talk very briefly because Mr. Larimer has a better story on FAST-41, but at the Greens Creek mine here in Juneau, we've been operating for over 35 years. Exploration is critical to extending our mine life. We were going through an environmental assessment process for our surface exploration program. EAs are only supposed to take 1 year, first by regulation and now by statute. We were over 2 years into the process, lots of delays. The opportunity came up when the FAST-41 transparency lists were implemented. We put that project. We were able to get that project on the list, and we got a notice of decision 6 months later because the permitting council was looking over the shoulder of the local Forest Service folks and says, "Where's our schedule? What is the holdup? How can we make this happen?" Permits now in hand. We have 5 years of certainty now for our surface exploration program, and Hecla as a company is now going to be spending more money on exploration, you know, nationwide, but especially in Alaska as a result of having that certainty. But I know our time is getting a little bit tight, so I'm going to pass it off to Mr. Larimer to talk a little bit more about his experience with FAST-41.
Well, thank you for the record, Dave Larimer. I want to take the perspective and drill this down from a FAST-41 down to an advanced project perspective. Representing Contango ore, we are one of the three fully covered projects on the Fast 41 dashboard in Alaska. What I have represented up here is what the Fast 41 dashboard looks like. I pulled this off the website. On the top, you'll see the three projects. And then if you haven't seen them, you can drill down, and each project shows exactly where it's at, what agencies, the federal agencies, are involved in there. And more specifically, this is the worked out timeline that we've worked out through the Permitting Council, through the federal regulations, and the program. This is a detailed back and forth that sets this schedule. And it's not just the Fast 41 Permitting Council trying to push projects. This is a two-way negotiation back and forth with the project proponents. There were areas that were going too fast for us that we knew we weren't going to be able to hit. So we actually had to slow them down, said, nope, this is too fast. We need this extra time to meet this deadline to do this correctly through here. So this is what transparency looks like. This is the accountability we look like as we go back to this. And this is the coordination effort that we go through this in this project. Many of these projects don't fail because of geology. We fail because of funding and uncertainty and capital. That 29 years delay of projects is capital time that's being spent and timeline wasted out there. So being able to truncate and have these set timelines that everyone can fight to and agree to is huge on the capital side. We have a higher confidence from a project side of what we're going to need to get through this project, what we need to do to get to this finish line so we can have this final mine decision. And frankly, it helps reduce the capital costs to get projects. At the end of the day, excuse me, this directly ties back to the state. If we can maneuver more of these projects that were on our diagram that are on state lands, if we can move them faster, this comes back to our state revenues. This is that added job valuation and creation. It's that infrastructure utilization. It makes Alaska competitive in our ranking going forward through here. Our tie-ins back to the state is we're on the right path. You know, we signed that Fast 41 MOU in August 2025. This links and at least has the OPUMP and state regulations that are nested underneath that. We'll at least have a parallel path. It's been really great for us. Additionally, this ensures that our state agencies, we need to look that our state agencies have the capacity to meet these coordinating timelines. We are up against the personnel shortages. We are having retirements out there, aging workforce that are retiring out there, especially in our regulations and our permitting side of our agencies that we can't backfill. We need that capacity to be able to maneuver these permits through this timeline. And, of course, avoiding the state bottlenecks, you know, once these milestones are achieved, we need to be disciplined in our procedures going forward on that. Oops, next slide. There we go. I'd like to shift briefly and talk kind of the next kind of paradigm shift that's out there. There's been a lot of talk with the DSO. Contango is a proponent of the DSO model, but I want to briefly talk what DSO is, what this is not, and what it does for us. First of all, the DSO is not a new model. In Nevada, when we were working there, this is a highly effective model of being able to utilize the infrastructure that's out there to be able to maneuver mines, maneuver material to where it needs to be so we can generate these projects. Basically, for Alaska, what this means is we want to be able to utilize our Alaskan infrastructure, and we want to lower our capital intensity costs for these projects because we're not looking at building mills. We're not looking at building large tailing facilities. And what this does is it streamlines our process, streamlines our capital, and aligns with the infrastructure that we have now. This is definitely a smaller footprint. It's environmentally has significant impacts that we're not generating these large projects out there. For Alaska, you know, this means we can maneuver these projects faster again. With a permitting reform, with this DSO model, we can maneuver projects from the advanced project phase to those mine decisions faster because we have reduced that large capital costs. You saw in our previous slides of the largest operating mines, of those, the majority of them do have large processing facilities, tailings ponds, because that's what we do. This model will not replace that. We have geology and we have the potential for our large mines that will support that. But these are all the other little dots that you see on the Alaska geologic maps. These are all deposits and prospects that have been orphaned through the past 30 or 40 years because they just weren't large enough and the economics weren't there enough to maneuver these into a mine. What this DSO model does is it reduces that capital. So now these are economic to be able to produce these metals. And these aren't just gold mines or silver mines. These are all the mines that have out there that are on our critical metals list out there. I do highlight the story of Manh Choh. This is this first successful story of this DSO approach here in Alaska. Our Johnson Tract project is the next one we're lining up for this DSO approach, where we're looking to mine ore the Johnson Tract, put it directly into a container, maneuver that container to a ship, and take that to a processing facility. At the end of the day, this is not the end-all, be-all fix, but this is part of our paradigm shift that will help maneuver more of our projects to that final mining site.
Great. Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for being here today. I appreciate your testimony. I did have a question, though, about this direct shipment of ore. Where does it eventually go to for processing?
For processing? Yep, for the record, Dave Larimer, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. We need to look at the proper facilities that can operate this. There are not a lot of facilities in Alaska that can. I mean, the Manh Choh is a great story where the Kinross facility there in Fairbanks did have capacity. The economics made sense for Manh Choh. For Johnson Tract, we are just part of our studies right now. There are not a lot of processing facilities in the U.S. or North America that can handle this. There are some in Canada, and that's a major flaw that we need to talk about in our future future programs in mining in Alaska. There are a lot of thoughts out there, a lot of talks out there that can Alaska be able to be a processing facility? Can we take this mined in Alaska and take it to that next phase where we're making metals in Alaska? There are areas out there that would be very supportive of this. Additionally, there are areas in Alaska that I would highly argue that can capture a lot of the concentrate that's going overseas. There is absolutely no capacity in the U.S. and in South America for additional processing of our base metals and our critical metals. And they get shipped up overseas to the Great Circle route, 100 miles right past Alaska, right over to our Asian markets. There is theories and there's thoughts out there that Alaska could not only be an exporter of these, but could be a hub, a nexus to be able to capture these. Obviously in the right place where we permit it, but there are a lot of opportunities for us to be able to capture the processing more in Alaska. I apologize for the end around. To directly answer your question, Senator, there's not a lot of processing facilities in Alaska that can do that, and it's part that we have to work out through the next couple of years of our permitting process.
Follow up. I certainly hope it's part of the discussion because I don't have a problem with mines. I think mines are fine as long as they're permitted properly and go through the process. I do not support Alaska just being a place where people come for the raw materials and they get exported. Yesterday, I spoke with a logistician who was with the truckers and AGC folks, and they said that they take all of their material and it gets shipped to China. Mm-hmm. All of their material, raw ore, gets sent to China. And so I know we're talking about some of our adversaries we have, but it seems like we're just getting this exported material and we're sending it to the lowest bidder, which is China, mm-hmm. for processing. Yeah. And I don't want Alaska to be seen as just a place where people can take stuff and leave.
For the record, Dave Larimer, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I absolutely agree. I ask you help me. Let's work together. This is one of your constituents. I'd love to sit down and talk to you more and continue those thoughts on this because we're short on time, but there are thoughts out there and we'd like to work with you on this.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the direct shipment stuff, so I push back a little bit and say it's actually not that new of a model. That's been what Red Dog's been doing during there. It might be new for gold, but it's not a new concept to Alaska. We talked a little bit about reclamation. My question is, for the direct shipment model, as we're, you know, taking large amounts of dirt out of Alaska, mm-hmm. or at least moved a large distance within Alaska, does reclamation then mean you have to bring back an approximately equal amount of material to backfill, or I'm not sure how the regulations work there?
For the record, Dave Lambert, Tango Ore, through the chair, Senator Myers. Reclamation is still mandated, of course, through the DNR in our process, and it's going to be mine-specific what reclamation means. We obviously have to return it, stabilize it, but from my understanding, for the record, it's not returning the exact material back. For our Johnson Tract project specifically, this will be an underground operation. So while we mine the ore, these aren't large volumes. We'll mine the ore out, that goes out, but we still have to backfill that part of that, and that's part of our reclamation plan. We'll be backfill. Mm-hmm. So part of our plan now that we're working through is what backfill material do we have that we mix and can basically stabilize the underground so we're not creating any other hazards through that. So directly answer your question, there's not a huge requirement to put it back, but part of our reclamation plan does dictate what we have to put back through there in that process.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I'll let you move on.
Okay. We're almost done. I want to shift gears finally to kind of the state position, what we can do now. I pulled out four pillars through here, kind of the recommendations from AMA on what we think the best place we can do to kind of continue our advancement of our discipline of mining through here. The top one is our agent capacity. You know, having these fully resourced permitted agencies. I briefly talked before about retirements coming up that are slowing down some permits right now. We need to protect this technical staffing levels and reduce those bottlenecks of the turnover in the state area. The second one is our jurisdictional control, you know, advancing our state 404 primacy, maintaining defensibility of waters, and strengthening our state-led coordination is huge for us. We do this best in Alaska, and these regulations are best done by Alaskans. Process and alignment. OPUMP has been a great facilitator for the mining industry going forward on these projects. We have some recommendations on modernizing, especially being through the FAST 41 process, not necessarily making it a part of the process, but that alignment. A lot of that visibility and being able to stick to those coordinated timelines is huge for us, and we're working with DNR and OPUMP now to do that. But that tracking system will be absolutely huge as we maneuver projects forward. And of course, enforcing those milestone disciplines back to that timeline is big. I want to briefly talk a little more about this, about our access and our data discipline. You know, to protect our mineral access, you know, in our state lands use, and we recommended that we require mineral potential evaluations on our lands. But to be able to do this, we recommended that we need to establish a state geologic data repository. This isn't new. It's been kicked around for a while. I'll admit I was a big opponent against this, but as I look more and more, the lands on the state of Alaska that are out there that are exploration-wise, a lot of that data gets lost. Companies get turned over. They get lost. We have members that are from our membership that are older. They have garages full of geologic data. This all starts with geologic data they've had through the years, and there's no place. It gets orphaned. When a company goes extinct, they can't just turn it away, and it's good geologic data. They don't want to throw it away. So a lot of our membership has asked, hey, help us. What can we do with this? One of our recommendations, and I'd love to continue more, is the GMAC, the Geologic Materials Center, is a prime facility that could be a great repository where we can collect the data from state lands and be able to turn this in. Further, as we maneuver forward, Alaska is one of the few places that doesn't require exploration on state lands to turn over that data yearly as part of a report. This has been a struggling point for me, but if I quantify this back to any lease I have done through private property, through an ANC, or anywhere else, they're the property owners, and we are required to turn over our data. It's something that needs to be talked about, and I'd encourage further discussion of how we can do this in the state, because as holders of the state land, we need to be able to protect our data that's collected out there so we can maneuver these. And I'll caveat this by saying I have worked on projects on state lands where I know there's been surveys done. And I know that I have to go back and spend the $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 to reduplicate surveys that have been out there because that data wasn't accessible or tied to the land. They're lost. So it's one. I don't want to say it's my passion project, but it's one of those I would recommend and would like to continue discussing with everyone in the resource committee about how we can best do this.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Yep.
Good news. Thank you again, and our contact information is on the screen.
Yes, thank you very much for the presentation.
Perfect.
Good. All right, next up we're going to hear about Red Dog Mine. So we will be hearing from Lance Miller and Greta Shirk. Greta, I can never say your last name, so I'll let Shirk. Okay, thank you. And Greta Shirk, she is the Senior Advisor in Government and External Affairs for Red Dog Mine. So welcome.
How would you like this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greta Shirk, Senior Advisor for Government and External Affairs for Tech Alaska. We're the operator of the Red Dog Mine.
And for the record, Lance Miller, Vice President, Natural Resources for NANA, and we're the landowner of Red Dog Mine.
Thanks for having us today. We're going to jump right in.
So, you know, I think we all know about, everybody here knows about ANCs, but it's always nice to see and remind ourselves of NANA's mission, which is like many ANCs. It's really to, you know, improve the quality of our shareholders. And this picture, though, is really a classic. It's John Schaefer on the left, Robert Newland on the right, pointing back in the day at the main Red Dog deposit before it was mined. And Robert Newland was a well-known, of course, John Schaefer, rather, was an early president and an early leader, and Robert Newland was a chair, and actually the deposit we're mining today, Okaluk, is named after him. today. Again, NANA has about 15,000 shareholders. About 40% live in the region now. We've also seen a change in the last 10 years from people living in region to outside, and then throughout the state, the nation, and internationally.
Oops. What do you hear?
I don't know if we can just do that.
Okay. Madam Chair, I know you have been to Red Dog Operations a couple of times, and thank you for taking the time to visit last August. And Senator Rauscher, I know, has visited site. But for committee members who are less familiar with Red Dog and have not had, we haven't had the opportunity to have you up just yet, I wanted to cover some geographic statistics here. We're located about 620 miles northwest of Anchorage, about 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle. We're located at the western end of the Brooks Range and have been operating since 1989. And we're really proud to be the largest critical mineral producer in the United States.
So again, I think this isn't new, but a couple of things to point out that I always like to think of ANCSA. Of course, the tipping point was really discovery of oil in Prudhoe Bay and the need for the 800-mile taps across native lands. So that created this, as we know, unique thing. And we'll talk a little bit more, but the other important point is 7I, 7J, the revenue sharing, of course, from subsurface minerals, oil and gas, and large timber. You receive at an ANC level, and then that's distributed to the other 11 ANCs, and through 7J, of course, 50% of that goes to their village corporations. And we're having a lot of discussions with even Ivanka and others about what this means in coming years. And I'll talk a little bit more about the importance of minerals for 7I. This is a whole session too. but I think people know the story pretty well. But it just some highlights, you know. The early leaders of NANA really had a vision. And then there was, of course, great geologic endowment there. But it started before 81, 82, really in the late 60s. Bob Baker is credited with finding the, you know, the orange kind of kill zones, if you will, the red creeks and stuff, and working with a guy, Irv Talley, at the USGS. But that then spurred a discussion of community consultation and meetings for about 10 years to get NANA shareholders on side. Because at that time, you were really transitioning from mostly a subsistence economy to a cash economy. And in those days, it was really Coleman lanterns were the thing. You know, there wasn't even electricity in a lot of the villages. But then it led to a letter of intent between NANA and then Cominco, and this, we call it landmark agreement. It really was. It's still looked at as a model globally for interaction with, you know, a native landowner and mining companies for development. Just a little sort of situational awareness, of course, a Northwest Arctic borough about the size of Indiana, 7,500 people in it, 11 villages, no roads, sometimes Red Dog's the 12th village. And I think another interesting history here, though, is back to the early leaders and what they saw with the potential of Red Dog was using that as an economic base to create a borough so there could be self-governance. And we'll talk more about the importance for Red Dog as far as, you know, economic impact for the borough. But that's what made the borough was Red Dog. And kind of a fact sometimes we don't talk about too much, but this is on the record and everybody knows, Red Dog was originally in the North Slope borough. And that was a whole nother story to have it be in the NANA borough or the Northwest Arctic borough. Anyways, that's a short story there. Thanks.
Just to give you an idea of the some statistics around the operation, we have an approximately 100-day shipping season and approximately 120-day exploration season in the district. Our production typically ranges from 1 to 1.3 million wet metric tons of concentrate every year. And then in terms of Red Dog deposits, we have the main deposit that has been mined out, the Kinnaik deposit, which is expected to be mined out in quarter three of this year of 2026. And then as Lance mentioned, the Okluk deposit, which is we began mining in 2010 and is anticipated to be mined out by 2031. And of course, all of these deposits are located on NANA lands. few more statistics here on the screen. We operate 8 really big diesel generators at site to power the operation, 5.0 megawatts per unit, 24.5 megawatts required, and then we burn approximately 40,000 gallons of diesel per day. This equates to about 20 million gallons of diesel annually, and that includes the diesel needed to operate ore trucks and pickup trucks that you see there on the in the photo. In terms of air freight, in 2025 alone, we flew in just over 5 million pounds of freight using 192 flights on Northern Air Cargo 737s and 15 of Linden's Hercs again last year. And that just makes up all the things you could imagine it takes to operate a mine in above the Arctic Circle year-round.
Oh, I might also add, and of course, Alaska Airlines charters for people 2 to 3 times a week, depending on the busyness.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And, we're talking about air traffic into the operation, we also operate, or we charter Bering Air and now Kavik Air, which is a NANA-owned airline out of the region, and they provide air transportation services for the workforce who live in the 11 communities around the region. And our rotation days are 2 times a week, and typically people work a balanced schedule. Most of the workforce now works a 2-week on, 2-week off schedule. In some cases, there are people who work a 4-2 or a 6-3. It varies around the operation and varies from company to company.
So we touched on this earlier, and I know it came up, of course, in the other conversation. Yet Red Dog has been a major contributor to 7i. You can see the numbers through last year's $2.2 billion distributed. The numbers from 14 to 20, and the numbers are about the same the last 10, 15 years, at rough numbers, 70 plus, some years up to 80 plus percent of 7i is from Red Dog. So it is significant. Other benefits, the payment in lieu of taxes, the PILT, it makes up about 85% of the budget, and I think Greta will get into a little more of that. And then, of course, the shareholder jobs are significant and important. This one, and this is a little different than the number Deantha showed, and I think it's really because there has been a little other 7i. So these numbers, and it often depends fiscal year, calendar year, how you do it. But rough numbers, it's still in that, $3.5 billion. Again, out of that comes the distribution to the other ANCs. And then the $1.8 billion to the state, similarly to the other discussion, it's everything, taxes, mining license tax, corporate tax, and ADA payment, toll fees. And then to the borough, it's been $443 million to date. And then annual on the order of, $250 to $300 million for contractors, services, and goods and such in Alaska. And then the wages, this one varies too, depending on construction projects, but it's still, when you look at total with tech employees and contractors, it's usually in that 150 to 180 range annually.
Lance mentioned this a bit ago, but Red Dog pays a payment in lieu of taxes to the Northwest Arctic Borough. It ranges annually from $17.5 to $22 million a year. It's a primary revenue for the Northwest Arctic Borough, makes up about 85% of the borough's budget. In addition to the PILT, there is also a village improvement fund that Red Dog pays into annually, and that payment ranges from $4 to $8 million annually, and that's based on the overall profit of the mine. The fund is administered by a village improvement commission, which is made up of an individual from each of the 11 communities, and they review applications quarterly and make award decisions based on need. And they look to distribute this fund equitably around the region to the communities. We wanted to give an example of some of the uses of this fund over the years, and there's a picture there on the screen of the community of Kivalina who utilized an award of $1 million as match funds for the construction of its evacuation and school site access road, and that was in about the 2020 timeframe. Port operations are the Red Dog port site is located about 52 miles from the mine itself. It's connected by the DeLong Mountain Transportation System, which was financed by the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority, or ADA. Just a fun fact, we like to point out the buildings you see there are concentrate storage buildings where the concentrate is stored during the winter before shipping season opens up. And those are the largest known buildings in the state in Alaska. In terms of some statistics here, shipping season runs from early July to late October. About 4,300 shipping containers brought in via ocean barge, about 96,000 tons of ocean freight. And then in terms of exports, again, about 1 million wet metric tons of zinc are exported annually, and then 200,000 wet metric tons of lead exported each year.
So a little on the flow of the concentrates. In that shipping season, Red Dog, it depends kind of on the year, but let's say roughly 8 smelters around the world, and you can see the breakdown, kind of Europe, Australia, Asia. Some in the past has a little bit gone to China, and then a significant amount to the Tech smelter in Trail, BC as well. Following up on maybe the previous presentation, and I know it'd be great to have processing in the state, but I'd say right now for a little perspective that over the last 15 years, the world, China mostly, but has overbuilt on smelters. So the costs, called the treatment charges or refining costs, to treat a ton of ore are at historic lows. So if you were in a business, you wouldn't want to really be in the smelter business today. The miners are making the money. So this just an economic perspective there. And then there's a lot of other challenges, of course, as we all know, with power, cost of power, to have something like a smelter in Alaska. But it's always something that needs to be looked at and capture the full value. But that's just a little perspective on the kind of the economics of that.
Yeah. Senator Klayman.
Specifically to that question about where are the smelters, and it sounds like most of them are in China, does that effectively mean somebody that is buying the ore, they figure it's less expensive to not have it refined and put the greater weight on ships, send it to China, have China process it, and send a lighter weight back out after it's been processed, so that one of the benefits of having smelters closer to the mineral is that the weight that gets shipped is less, but even with that additional shipping weight, they still come out less expensive to send to Asia.
Yep, still do. And for that, I think answer your question also, concentrate is about 52% zinc, 54% zinc. So you're basically cutting it in half of what you would potentially have to ship. But also didn't want to give the impression it's all in China. As you can see here, Europe is a big taker, Australia, Korea, we send to Boliden in Sweden. So it's not just about China. It's about the infrastructure that's set up globally for smelters for base metals around the world.
All right. I'll let you move on. Yeah. Senator Wilikowski.
On that point, thank you. I mean, what has there been serious look at trying to do a smelter here in Alaska? I know in Iceland, they have aluminum smelters, and they provide low-cost hydro for the entire country. Has there been any serious analysis about doing that here?
Well, I think, and Dave Larimer touched a little bit on some of that and the earlier presentation. There's been lots of, I don't know there's been serious talk, to be honest, but there's been a lot of talk over the decades about trying to do that. But it does, you'll need, I'll throw out low single-digit per kilowatt hour type of power to do it. And you'd probably actually, I'm not sure a company would build one here. So that might be, some of these places, it's considered infrastructure that a country might put into. Certainly China does that. So it's a tough nut, but one that still needs to be looked at because it would add value. But the other thing is, if I may, is if there were a smelter here, you're not going to ship all your concentrate to one smelter. One, because it might not be able to take it all if it's a big mine. And two, just like almost your financial portfolio, you don't put everything in one, because if something goes bad at a smelter, you're sunk. So you actually want to distribute it just for kind of security of producing metal as well as the competition.
All right, I'll let you move on.
Thank you. Well, shifting gears here, we wanted to share some information about the subsistence committee that was established in the 1982 agreement between NANA and then Cominco, now TEC. The subsistence committee is made up of four local hunters from each of the communities of Noatak and Kivalina, and this committee provides oversight to the operation when it comes to subsistence migrations for caribou and marine mammal migrations through the mine and through the port area. They're really there to offer local and traditional knowledge when it comes to possible impacts of the operation to caribou and sea mammal migrations. An example that I like to share is it's in policy at Red Dog that when caribou are migrating through the haul road, through the DeLong Mountain transportation system, or trucks and light vehicles are required to stop until the herd has migrated through that area. Another example we share is that there have been times in the past when there are barges waiting out at sea when beluga and other sea mammals are migrating through the port area, and the subsistence committee has advised the operation to pause traffic through that area until they are safe distance away and until the nearby communities could adequately harvest those sea mammals. And a photo on the screen you see there is that it's the first subsistence committee that was established to provide that oversight at Red Dog. In recent years, there have, I think about 4 or 5 years, there was the first woman hunter to be added to the subsistence committee, which I think is really neat. In terms of our workforce, these are TEC Alaska only numbers. As part of the 1982 agreement, NANA shareholders have a hiring preference at Red Dog. And of 653 regular employees, about 53.5% are NANA shareholders as of the end of last year. And of the 150 temporary employees, about 94% of those are shareholders. 23.5% of our workforce are female. This has been a concerted effort by the operation to really increase and diversify the workforce. I could remember a time when it was the number teetered around 8%, and we have just seen that grow in recent years, and really proud of that number.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. NANA, rough numbers, when you add the contractors, which are large part NANA contractors, it's, there are several hundred employees too. So that's why you'll see different numbers, sometimes 600 to 1,000. And kind of overall, it is around that 900 to 1,000 all in.
And I'll take the liberty to give my niece a little shout out there and put a little heart around her face. So she no longer works there, but she has held some summer jobs there over the years. And speaking of summer hire, many college students have taken internships at Red Dog or just utilized the opportunities up there through summer employment to help fund technical program, vocational technical programs and their college.
Like Greta.
Yeah, I did. Right. I did start my career out there at Red Dog right out of high school as a core sampler. Thank you. As I said, I mentioned earlier, the pits on NANA lands are expected to be exhausted by 2031, and TEC has an advanced exploration project on adjacent state lands. I'll have Lance cover some of those aspects.
Sure, and as just follow up to highlight what Greta said, so the state lands, well, two things, and Senator Klayman asked about that. These new deposits are state of Alaska lands, and they're significant deposits, and they are being operated by Tech America, not the Red Dog thing. So I'm just sort of speaking as a geologist on this. But as you can see here, the red in the foreground, the deposits that have been mined or are being mined, the tailings facilities, the pond, of course, and then the dotted red or yellow line is Exploration Road. And actually, it's now completed about 6.5 miles to right where that pullout box is. Yeah, right there. And that's going to be the planned site for a portal, which the portal is just a name for where you go underground and put a, what's called a decline or a tunnel to access it. So the next step in this project is to get advance it so there's a sanction just to do the decline, which is going to be about 3.5 miles. So importantly, sometimes, you know, here people are like, you're going underground, you're mining. This isn't for mining. This is to get access to the underground for better definition of the deposit so you can ultimately make that sanction decision. So it still is effectively in advanced stage exploration. They're working on a pre-feasibility right now. And then the last bullet here, we also wanted to highlight, because we talk about all this stuff, we talk about mine closure, 2031, reclamation closure plan, big lift, that's got to be done, interest of everybody, especially NANA and Tech, that it's done right. But at the same time, in parallel, advancing what we're calling mine life extension. So the goal is, ideally, that we do keep mining and jobs and payments to the borough and everything going for decades to come. But it's not a done deal. So a lot of work, money, time, everything is going to have to go in engineering, geology to make this happen. The resource is significant at Angarok and Arcturok, again, on state lands. And the state land, we don't have it on this, but it's really, it kind of cuts diagonal across the slide. Yeah, just the yellow line starts on NANA land and then goes on state land. So everything to the west there is actually on state land as well.
Gotcha.
And then the next slide is going to be a cross section. There we go. Looking through these deposits, just had to show this. So this is a slice through the earth and kind of highlights the importance of why you have to go underground. These deposits are 2,000 to 3,000 feet below surface, and the amount of drilling you'd have to do to get enough close space samples for confidence to mine is really cost prohibitive. So the balance is to get underground to get a better idea of what the ore really looks like. So that's the reason here why you have to go underground and why this roughly 3.5 mile decline to access the underground. And then we could talk about the geology, but we won't much.
And before we it doesn't sound okay. That's working. Before we wrap up, I just want to emphasize something that Lance touched on, is that we, in terms of mine life extension, I sometimes hear people talk about it like it is a guarantee, but I want to emphasize that it absolutely is not. That is our hope, is to extend mine life beyond 2031 and perpetuate the benefits that Red Dog has delivered to the region and across Alaska. Again, we need several more years of exploration activity at those deposits before it is decided whether they're economic to develop. There's a lot ahead in terms of exploration and permitting. So I wanted to just emphasize that point.
Quote. I can't help the quote, you know. Mining is not everything. Well, to us, it obviously is. But, you know, Max Planck said this, the father of quantum theory, and I just love it. Mining is not everything, but without mining, everything is nothing, if you think about it that way. So, thank you.
Thanks, Lance. And that concludes our presentation. And to the members who have not been to a site yet, we'd enjoy having you up at a future tour. So we'll follow up with future opportunities for tours of the operation at some point. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Greta and Lance, for the presentation.
It's a great tour.
Thank you. So we're going to move on now to the next presenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here. The next presentation is a wonderful opportunity through the University of Alaska Fairbanks for a critical mineral project. And this is an accelerated project. It's a grant being offered by the National Science Foundation. Dr. Leanne Monk is here with us from UAF, and Steve Masterman, who is a renowned geologist. They have been doing tremendous work on this, and I'm thrilled that they'll be presenting, and we're looking forward to hearing that grant being given to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you, everyone, for having us here today. We're delighted to follow the amazing presentations of AMA and NANA and TEC for Red Dog. Of course, they're close partners of ours. So the Alaska Critical Mineral Accelerator is a project that we have submitted to the National Science Foundation for funding. I believe we spoke with you all almost a year ago when first introduced it. This has been going on for 18 months, the review process. We started with, you know, there were 300 letters sent in nationwide. We are now one of 15 finalists. So we had our site visit 2 weeks ago, 8 NSF folks, 40 of our partners, day and a half, and it went extremely well. So we're very happy to report that we felt there was nothing more we could have done to make it great, and we feel like the NSF gave us signals that they agreed with that. So that you already introduced us. Thank you for that. So I'm here, Dr. Leanne Monk, with Dr. Lance Miller and Steve Masterman. I will lead the accelerator as the CEO PI. Steve is currently co-PI and interim director of the R&D portion, and Lance is co-PI and advisory board chair. So what is it? The NSF Regional Innovation Engines Program has only been around the NSF for a few years. This is just the second round that they are awarding. It is the largest award that the NSF gives. It's an economic development award. It is not a research award to a university. So often, you know, that's what NSF is typically doing. However, they are shifting a lot of the way they are funding projects, and the economic development piece is front and center. So ours is a statewide economic development program to grow and sustain innovation through place-based, here in Alaska, R&D, and critical minerals is our topic. So it's science and technology around advancing the production of critical minerals in the state of Alaska to drive economic competitiveness. So the mandate of the ENGINE program is that you have a region. Our region is all of Alaska, and you'll see our map and you'll know why, and it'll just be something you already know. So what is it going to do? It's going to stimulate the economy here through industry-driven R&D. So this is not the researchers at the university going to industry and saying, hey, I want to do X, Y, Z. This is industry comes to us and says, okay, look, you know, Lance will talk about this. A lot of the mining companies are not doing their own R&D. And so that has to get done at a place like a university with collaboration with national laboratories, other universities nationwide. And the industry will adopt the technologies. Okay, so we are going to create new things that the industry can use to help increase critical mineral production. This will create new businesses in the state. The ENGINE program is to stimulate economic activity in places that have not traditionally benefited from the tech boom in the nation. So Silicon Valley, right, the typical places you think of. And so that's one of the reasons why our project is so appealing to the NSF. It's Alaska. We have the most critical minerals, not just in the number of, but the quantity of in the nation. So we have a lot of potential. So workforce development front and center. So this is research and development, translating that research into commercial things or processes that the industry can use, and having jobs retained and created along that pathway. So it's a $160 million opportunity for the state of Alaska, and with the focus on the minerals and mining sector. Oops, doing all sorts of things. Okay. One very awesome piece of this is that we have a multi-sector leadership team. This is one of the things that we came out of the gate with that the NSF said, that's what we want to see. We don't want a bunch of academic faculty. we want that, but we want people, so I'm an R&D expert, right? Steve has decades of experience working in the industry, being our state geologist. Christy Bell is, the business and economic development expert in our state. Lance, of course, is, representing Alaska Native Corporation and the industry. And then Liz, she was actually a former student of mine who has started a biomining tech startup in Denver. She's from Palmer, and she wants to spin off part of her company here in Alaska as part of this accelerator. Oh my gosh. Okay, now this is the other part of what makes the engine so unique is the requirement for a massive multi-sector partner coalition. And we have what I believe is the best one. When I look across all the engines, there's nothing like it. You can only do this in Alaska. So the industry, tech, Red Dog Mine, Northern Star Resources, you see them there. And by the way, many of these are on state land. They're doing exploration on state land. Of course, Lance just said, the two new deposits at Red Dog are on state land. So increasing revenue from mining on state lands. Alaska Native Corporations are key. We have venture capital, a lot of the national labs. They want to come here and they want to work on Alaskan deposits and projects, and they have to have a platform run by Alaskans. So we provide that. And then our nonprofit coalition, of course, Alaska Miners Association. So extremely important. We have over 40 partners. And so we could do a lot about telling you about all the details, but this is just one slide. This shows all three pillars of the engine: use-inspired R&D, and our focus is in exploration, recovery, and production of critical minerals. So an example, biomining, right? So if we just take Ambler Road, for example, what if there isn't a road? How do we get the metals out? So we talk with Trilogy and Ambler, and one of the big issues is all the waste, right? So can we use new technologies to extract metals and not have to move a bunch of rock out, right? So that's an example. Artificial intelligence, Dave Larimer talked about the database, so that's an important piece of what we can contribute and help with, but also, using the most advanced technologies in ways, and these projects are so complex with multiple layers of data and information. And so ways that we can bring that together to make decision-making, lower risk, those sorts of things. And then the middle part of this diagram is the work of the engine. So the NSF engine accelerator ecosystem. So the NSF is looking for us to build an ecosystem that provides sustainability for our region of service. So we listen to industry. They tell us, okay, here are the things we need to do. And by the way, a lot of this is things they would not do on their own, right? So we're working with them, bringing the innovation that they need, testing, prototyping, right? That's the middle part with the gear, the work. and outcomes, more critical mineral production. And the TRL, by the way, is technology readiness level. So that's just a term where we advance, you know, from just an idea all the way to, you know, a production of critical minerals in this case. And workforce development is key, as I mentioned, and we kind of divide it into these three areas of training and education, you know, skills and certifications, career pathways, industry partnerships. So examples of that are, you know, the mining industry can't provide all the training that they need for their employees. So that, where's that going to happen, right? And we're talking about the aging workforce, you know, young people leaving. But here we can provide new, cool, high-tech career pathways that do not exist, right? I mean, there's a lot. Like there's, you know, the digital mine twins where you can operate a mine, you know, from hundreds or thousands of miles away, right, sitting in your living room. And there are these things that are happening in other parts of the world that we can bring here. And, of course, the opportunity to have the jobs, right? So the jobs exist. We need more Alaskans trained and trained here to fill those positions. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Masterman.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. And for the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Deputy Director of Alaska Critical Minerals Collaborative at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I retired from being state geologist 4 years ago. And when I did that, I didn't think I would ever be back sitting here. So it's good to be back and see you all again. It's you never say never, I guess. So, yeah, that was a great introduction. And, yeah, as Leanne mentioned, this is a pretty sizable opportunity, $160 million over 10 years from the National Science Foundation. And the way they work it is they don't give you a check for $160 million right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. They say, okay, we're going to give you $15 million for the first 2 years, and we're going to see how you do. And if you do what you said you were going to do, and your partners do what they said they were going to do, and hopefully the state does what the state says it's going to do, then we'll give you the next phase. And the next phase is 3 years at $15 million a year. And then they reevaluate you at the end of that phase. And if you're still doing what you said you were going to do and you're on track, then the follow-up, the last 5 years is $20 million a year. So that adds up to $160 million over the 10-year period. And part of that is so that you can build the engine. So the first 2 years are to build the engine, and then in the third through the 10th year, it's basically adding fuel. So they want to see if we can build a structure that they can expand on with additional funding later on. So we put in an ask through our university to the state, to the governor, for $3 million a year to demonstrate that the state also supports this. And one of the things that the National Science Foundation has made abundantly clear is that they value state support and state participation in these projects. All of the existing engines have some magnitude of state support, and none of them that have been funded have no state support. So when we met with them, they were very curious about the status of our request to the state. And there was quite a few questions about that. Anyway, so in addition to the $160 million that we hope to receive from the National Science Foundation and the funding that we hope to receive from the state, our industry partners have contributed to date roughly $300 million, and most of that, I must admit, is in kind contributions, so access to data, access to mine sites, technical input from their staff, working with their staff time, access to drill core, and as our project unfolds, that number is going to grow. We have one of our projects is, as Dr. Monk mentioned at the Pogo mine, looking at recovering bismuth and tellurium. And so we are going to do research to de-risk that for the mine. If it looks like it's economic, they have committed to build it. And that they will spend the money to build it and operate it and recover the metals. Obviously, then they will sell them. Same with another project that we have, which is with the Aleut and Doyen Native Corporations and a couple companies, one called MDF Resources and the other one called Vectors. Those those partner organizations have committed to obtaining the samples and doing a bunch of analytical work on those and in support of the analytical work and part of the project that we'll do. So it's hard to quantify those commitments directly, but these companies are investing real money in terms of their staff time and the money that they're spending on helping us with these projects. So the NSF has an objective of a return on investment of tenfold. And that's why we come up with an objective of $1.6 billion return on their investment over the 10 years of the engine. And that will come through increased mineral production, jobs created, partner spending, additional contributions from other agencies, obviously from the state. So it's kind of everything in that bucket, if you will. But it's a pretty big objective and a very valuable one if we succeed. So next slide, please. So what we asked for, as I mentioned, was $3 million for the state, from the state to help us and to demonstrate that commitment from the state to the National Science Foundation. And so as Dr. Monk mentioned, what we need to start with is the R&D to help solve the problems that the industry has. And as she mentioned, this is not an academic research project. These are problems that the industry is bringing to us and say we need help to solve this problem. The recovery of bismuth and tellurium at the Red Dog mine, at the Pogo mine, was brought to us by the Pogo people. We've had conversations with Tech and with NANA about what we can do at the Red Dog mine. And we addressed all the opportunities across the mine site, and there's a lot of opportunities there. And we have zeroed in on looking at the recovery of additional metals from their stockpiles. So they have tens of millions of tons, I think, of stockpile material on the surface. And if we can help them make that economic, then they will be producing those metals and helping keep jobs and revenue to the Northwest Arctic Borough. So it's the R&D, but it's also helping train the workforce through educating students. And both advanced levels, PhDs, but also undergraduates and graduates as well. And attracting new businesses to Alaska is a big part of that. As Dr. Monk mentioned, there's a couple of businesses already interested in opening sort of satellite companies here in the state, if you will. And so attracting new businesses to our state is a big part of what we hope to do and a big part of what the engine is all about. Next slide. So what benefit does it do to the state of Alaska? And I know we're asking for funding, but what will that translate to? Will it translate into any additional revenue for the state? And I think the answer that we have is yes, it will. As Dr. Monk mentioned, many of our partners are working on projects on state land. Graphite One is working on a graphite deposit that's on state land. Tech's new deposits that they hope to develop are also on state land. Pogo is on state land. The Ambler Mining District is on state land. And Alaska Energy Metals in the Alaska Range and looking at developing nickel and platinum group metals is also on state land. So many of our partners are on state land, and if we help them be successful, then we will help generate revenue, obviously through mining license tax and other taxation benefits to the state. One project in particular, the Pogo project, we did some really quick back of the envelope calculations on what that would translate to in mining license taxes if it's successful. And we came up with the answer of about $1.4 million a year in additional tax revenue to the state that would start after about 3 years and would proceed through the entire mine of life from that point on. So it's hard to quantify these things. I know people want to know an answer, but it's really hard to put numbers on them. So we're kind of reluctant to do that. But we do feel very clearly that it will drive revenue to the state in terms of additional tax benefits. Okay, next slide. Now I'll turn it over to
Dr. Hello, Lance. Lance Miller for the record. Just a couple slides left here. A busy map, you saw kind of a version of this earlier. We took a version of Alaska Miners one. But I'd like to highlight, Deantha talked about the mines, the communities, All the black dots, though, that's kind of important. We put all the communities with potential workforce. So there's 80, 85 communities with mining workforce today. You know, if some of these other deposits can be developed, it's significant for jobs, real jobs. The other thing I like about this map is it's sort of lost, but the dark roads, and we told this to NSF, like that's our road infrastructure in Alaska. So that's another big hurdle, right? And anything we can do to lower the cost of these remote deposits, because we're not going to get roads to a lot of them probably, is significant. So again, you know, the other blue dots here, 5,000 critical mineral occurrences, as Steve Masterman would tell me, with all the occurrences, it's like 7,000. So we have a lot. We know that. We talked about 7i, 7j. That 4.6 just threw out another number for you guys. That's total. That's a rough number of total. That includes oil and gas, Sea Alaska timber, everything over the years. Previous discussion, we talked about the Red Dog contribution. I think with that, you know, this is just a good way to kind of the perspective. And another aspect, I think, about this, which can go to just the final one, I guess, is I was thinking about this, and I know I've been in front of you folks before in different capacities, whether it's NANA or Minerals Commission and such, but also in like 2011, 2012, there was critical and strategic minerals conferences by DNR, our then Senator Sullivan, when he was there. And then the university had a bunch. And, you know, the theme, the message is always the same. It's like, let's have a plan. Let's try to get everybody together. Let's think holistically. Back to even the issue of refining on site. You know, I think, you know, you mentioned it's like, has it really been looked at? It's been talked about a lot, but no. So I think this is just an opportunity today with the super cycle of metals and Mike Satre mentioned and Deantha, the awareness globally, nationally of metals, critical metals. Alaska has the potential. And again, there really has been no holistic program to this so far at all, period. And this is an opportunity. It may not solve all these lofty goals, but we got to start somewhere. And having this kind of money from NSF and the partners is significant, so a little bit from the state, just to see something, even I'll leave it at that, follow up, is important. And, you know, we talk about the resources, minerals, but I think the other aspect, it's really, this is also the time these conversations morph into workforce, keeping people around. So it's really leveraging our natural and our human resources now for some future that we probably don't really know what it's going to look like, but at least we might have a pathway to try to get there. And I haven't seen that yet. So it's just one more opportunity that's kind of right now. Timing seems good. So with that, thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation, Dr. Monk, is it?
Yeah.
You mentioned that some of these R&D and technology requests are from the industry. I'm wondering if there was any thought about ways to be able to recoup maybe, I don't know, like just fees from the industry, since they're the ones that are really the ones who want to benefit from the technology, and you guys are the smarts and you guys are the brains of it to get it to that point. So I'm just trying to think of another way other than general funds. I think general funds are fine, but I think, are there other ways to get that money?
For the record, Leanne Monk, through the chair, thank you, Senator Kawasaki, for that question. And yes, there is a built-in mechanism within our engine proposal and our plan to have a request for proposals where we attract the best talent from the nation to submit proposals to us. And there will be many requirements for Alaskan pieces, Alaskan project, Alaskan company has to be involved. And we're considering a match from that industry. Like, if it's going to be at Pogo or, you know, at Graphite One, they will have to make a match. In the bigger picture, though, to answer your question, is that this is a partnership with from the federal government, the state of Alaska, the partner coalition. So all three have to, that's the magic sauce, right? That's the recipe. And so we have other ways to bring resources to the projects, but the state commitment and support makes our application highly competitive. So without that, and, you know, we can discuss, you know, what does it look like? I mean, we've made a proposal, right? But it can't be nothing. We have to have something.
Thank you. And just to follow up, you mentioned increasing the quality of the condensate and things like improving refining capacity or refining ability. And I would like you to also maybe research ways that you can cheaply smelt products within the state, mm-hmm. because we're talking about not just exporting our raw material to wherever around the world, but actually utilizing it in state as best we can. And so the technology, that's a technology thing I'd like you to work on.
Yeah, and we are. So we're, and it's more of like, it's more of not necessarily like maybe traditional smelter, but it would be, you know, like a biomining in situ leaching, you know, technology that is lower impact, lower cost, lower energy. So it's definitely on the docket.
Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I think about the money that's available for this investment, part of it makes me think it's a public-private partnership to figure out what sites might be really good to start exploring and developing. And then I start thinking, but the money runs out pretty quickly, even though it's a lot of money. The other side would be not so much figuring out which are good deposits, but instead figuring out more after you've got the deposit, being more effective and efficient of removing that and then getting it or selling it and making it to market. Is the focus going to be more one or the other in terms of the innovation work?
So for the record, Leanne Monk through the chair. Thank you, Senator Klayman. The focus is more on, the new technologies that can be brought here to the state, to projects, to increase production, lower costs, lower impact. And so that's really the focus. So, for example, we will have a committee that will rank projects, right? I mean, we're coming out of the gate with the lowest lying fruit that will be a success in 2 years. But this, like you said, it's a long-term thing, and it's we have to have a committee of all the stakeholders come together to vet the projects, make sure we're making the best choices of where to apply the technology to get the most benefit for all of Alaska.
If I could add something to that too, again, Lance Miller here. A lot of, 20, 30 years ago, the large companies had R&D arms, and today they really don't. And I know even, a lot of companies like to be fast, the big companies like to be fast followers. So they are interested in this, but they don't want to do it themselves. But they, once there's a plan, and back to, as Leanne said, the use-inspired R&D is really critical. Like you've heard talk about, getting metals out of mine water, high acid rock, drainage water. We're looking at all those things, but they've been done, kind of attempted in some places, but not really that economically. So there's a lot of those things that are floating out there that you actually have to finally just get an industry partner that wants at least to use the site to try it. And then some of it's even not a lot of money to get going. It's the expertise and the focus. That helps. Yeah.
If I could just add through the chair, I think it's a really interesting question, Senator Klayman. For the record, Steve Masterman. One piece of this that I think maybe gets overlooked is that this is, from the National Science Foundation's perspective, what they want to do is they want to create an environment in the state where innovation happens, where research and development happens, but is not necessarily funded by the government, that it's funded by industry. So one of the things that is part of the engine is developing companies. Like, you develop the technology, and then you spin that out as a company. And then that company takes that technology and commercializes it and applies it to other mining projects, both here in the state and outside of the state. And so the idea is to build that network of companies within Alaska that has that innovative and entrepreneurial spirit to drive those innovations both here in state but also nationally.
Very good. Well, thank you to all of you for presenting today. That was a great presentation, good summary of the accelerator. All right, and that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be on Friday, February 27th, and on the agenda will be three bills, Senate Joint Resolution 26, Support Native Corporation Business Development Program, House Joint Resolution 29, Ban on Russian Seafood, and House Bill 33, Conflict of Interest, Board of Fisheries and Game, which should be very entertaining. We will now adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:09 p.m.